This is an AMI podcast.
Welcome to the best of Double Tap on YouTube. Your chance to catch up on the videos we posted this week. Now, here's your hosts, Stephen Scott and Sean Preece.
Hey guys, welcome to another Double Tap on YouTube. I am Stephen Scott.
And I am Sean Preece. Hello.
Hello, Sean Preece. Tell me, what's your favourite animal?
Oh, that's a difficult one, Stephen. I want to say dog, but I also want to say chicken, fried.
Quite different.
Yes.
Don't get mixed up. Very important. Do you know, I'm going to say rabbits.
I see where you're going today. Clever.
Yeah. See, the thing is, you can't get away with anything here on YouTube because people know what we're going to talk about before we even start because it's in the title. So you can't get away with it anymore. I'm going to talk today about the Rabbit R1. This is this amazing new AI device which has lots of interesting capability. Our good friend Robin Christofferson from AbilityNet in the UK, he has been writing about this on the AbilityNet blog. He joins us now. Robin, good to have you here on YouTube. We've got you onto YouTube. You hate YouTube, don't you?
Yes, I do. No, I don't. I love it. I'm so pleased to be here, and I'm going to remember to look at the camera at all times.
We're all blind. Who cares? Are we even looking at the camera? Who knows?
We don't know.
Tell us in the comments. Listen, it's great to have you here with us on the show because I want to talk to you about your article, which was very interesting, talking about Rabbit R1. Maybe you could start by explaining to people who don't know what it is, maybe a little bit about this device and what makes it stand out to you.
Yeah, so we had the Consumer Electronics Show. That's the big mainstream tech show a couple of months ago. And the major takeaway from CES, certainly the thing that got the most notice in the press, was the Rabbit R1. What is it? Well, it's a little gizmo, a little square device with a small screen, a little click wheel, and a couple of other things that we'll talk about in a moment. It's bright orange. I know rabbits don't usually come in that color, but it's very affordable at a couple of hundred dollars, US dollars, and it flew off the shelves, so you couldn't get one now, even if you wanted to. What is it? Okay, so it is a virtual assistant. Basically, it's powered by the likes of ChatGPT. It doesn't say exactly what is kind of behind the, you know, working behind the scenes. But the major difference, so obviously you can talk to it. It's got a camera that is actually a 360 rotating camera. Not 100% sure why it needs to rotate and why you can't just turn the device around, but anyway. And a number of other sensors. It's got microphones and a speaker and that sort of thing. So you can use it as you would any other virtual assistant. You can ask it things, all the stuff that we know about now, and you'll get the super smart responses that you would from the likes of ChatGPT, for example. But where it really kind of stands apart, the way that it has hopped ahead of all of the competition,
oh, very good. Very
is that it has this new idea of what's called a large action model. You've all heard of large language models, of course. That's the likes of, you know, Gemini and ChatGPT, etc. A large action model allows the smarts of the large language model, the super smart assistant, to have an impact in other things other than just getting you information and stuff like that. So, okay, what is a large action model? Well, we all know that you can interface with smart home devices, for example, using the S lady on your phone or your Echo. You can ask it to turn the lights on and off, you know, play music and stuff like that. But it's got a limited number of things it can do that actually interact with third party services. And that usually takes a formal collaboration between the two companies. So, you know, if you want to use Apple Music on your Echo, then that took a relationship between Apple and Amazon to make that happen. If you want to unlock your smart door lock on your house, then that takes a collaboration between your Echo, for example, and whoever is your smart door lock. I can't remember the name, the makes of any at the moment. and that usually happens with what's called an API, an application programming interface. That API is like a handshake between, in this case, you know, Apple or the Rabbit People, the Rabbit R1 manufacturers.
Also known as the Rabbit People. We're going to call them that for
I can't remember the name of them. Teenage...
Mutants.
Devices. Rabbit.
Ninja.
It's called Teenage Something. The people that have... apparently they're experts on design and this thing looks really cute. So basically it would take it would take a collaboration between, say, this Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle people and the other company that would be, you know, using your smart door locks and stuff like that. But with a large action model, it has this thing called Teach Mode. And what happens is you log onto a website, go onto a portal, and then interact with the website that you want to teach the rabbit how to use. And the large action model will learn about the UI of the different pages that you go through, what you click on to perform certain tasks. You know, if it was the website of, I don't know, your favorite local restaurant, for example, then it would learn what you have to click on to choose a number of people, the time of day for the table, the date, etc. Maybe any other access requirements or dietary preferences, I don't know, the sort of things you'd put in. And then it would be able to use that website from then on. And then, even though there was no collaboration between those two devices, those two companies, it will basically go away and use that website just when you pick up your little rabbit and say, book a table for 4 for 6 p.m. Next Saturday at Romano's or whatever it might be. So this is huge, not just for everyone, which is why, you know, it got so much press. It's basically taking the smarts of a virtual assistant and enabling it to work with everything, not just stuff that has that kind of official collaboration interaction. But it'll allow you to use websites in the first 1.0, and also they're promising apps as well. It'll be able to interact with apps on your phone. So really, really powerful. Promises to help us as disabled people even more than everybody else, because as we all know, using websites in particular can, you know, they're really complicated. There's loads of information on there. It's so much, you know, potential for not knowing what you're doing, not being able to interact with things, not getting the visual clues about, oh, here's the obvious button to click on because it's not marked up in a way that our screen reader kind of picks it out as an important button. And obviously, in the worst case scenario, we can't even use that website at all because it's not accessible. So, yeah, I don't know what you guys think about this idea of a large action model, but that was the kind of main cause of the excitement that people had. And I know what you're thinking, why do we need to have a device to do that? Why couldn't it be just an app, for example? Because your phone would be able to run all of these things, and it's got a camera and mics and stuff like that. I think also the press was saying this is the genius of the rabbit people, the Teenage Mutant people, that it actually is done in a device that is really cute, really affordable, and has, you know, can be that interface to whichever phone you've got, for example. You just have to carry this around and it will do those things for you in a much simpler interface. And the promise of it is that it will vastly simplify the interactions that you have with the digital world. You know, you can just press a button, talk to it, scroll a wheel if you want to, you know, look at more information than fits on the screen, or maybe just ask it to read it all out for you, that sort of thing. But yeah, promises to be much, much easier than navigating complex websites and apps that are potentially also inaccessible.
Wow. Okay. That was a very good description there, Robin. Well done. Very detailed. This reminds me of the training mode, at least, reminds me of recording macros back in the day. And you still do, actually, where you just record the keystrokes or the mouse movements you want to do for repetitive tasks. And then you just play them back later on. This is taken to the next level, right? And this is, as you mentioned, so cool. I'm interested, though. And I was thinking exactly that when you brought it up about, well, why isn't this just an app or a software? But I'm very interested in what do you see this achieving for you? Are you just thinking about this from the accessibility point of view, or do you see this taking over from every other voice assistant that you have? Are you quite happy to carry another device around with you?
It's a really good question. I don't know if I could buy it from Amazon for that price today. I'm not sure if I would, mainly because it's a V1 product. You know, it's version one. They are saying that certain other things, like the ability to teach it apps, aren't coming yet. I don't know if that will require new hardware. Maybe not. But I'd rather have something that, like you were saying, could be built into your phone that you've got anyway. So just, you know, have an alternative virtual assistant that is using the Rabbit OS lady, and maybe assign that to the action button if you've got an iPhone 15, that sort of thing. So yeah, I'd probably go for that if that were available. But yeah, I mean, the idea of not having to use apps or in particular websites definitely appeals to me. I love technology, but I don't necessarily like using it sometimes.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'd rather use a much simpler way of controlling things. Yep.
One of the interesting things that I spotted with this is that you essentially are logging into your various accounts through this device, if I'm understanding correctly. So you are actually using the device to log in. So is there a privacy concern here? Are there any issues around privacy? I know I sound like everyone's dad or granddad these days when I say things like this, but, you know, no one cares about privacy anymore,
no.
Right? But I do, kind of. I mean, you know, to some degree, I maybe should actually listen to the iPhone app that continually tells me that I've got 237 compromised
passwords.
Me too.
Just let's ignore that for a second and actually imagine I care. So, you know, on that basis, you know, would my data be safe using something like this if it's going off and logging in for me and doing all that?
Yes, and that's one of the big question marks, obviously. You know, how trusted are these people? You know, jury's out on that one, although, you know, the likes of Microsoft had a 400 million or 40 million user account breach a couple of months ago. So, you know, is any company safe in that regard?
That's a good question. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a few other question marks. Do you have to train it on every website that you want to then use that doesn't have this kind of API collaboration already in place, you know, or will other people's kind of teaching of their of common websites fall into a big bucket that, you know, means that the rabbit gets smarter and smarter? Because I don't want necessarily to have to teach it all of these. And so that kind of leads on to the question, well, if other people have trained it, then do I just give the rabbit my personal data, you know, everything about me, my name, my passwords for all these different common sites that I use, my, you know, payment details, all the different things that you'd have to have that it would need to know to be able to go off to a random website and buy something for me, or book a ticket for something, that kind of thing. So, yeah, there's still quite a few question marks. But I think the principle that people are getting excited about is the fact that this new wave of AI goodness could actually mean that we won't have to physically click through or tap through websites or apps ourselves anymore.
A really important question, isn't it? Because, you know, to stretch this rabbit metaphor as far as we can go, you know, does it allow us to leap over the barrier of inaccessibility?
Oh, well done. That was beautiful.
It's a serious question, though, right? Because if you think, well, hang on, does this let developers off the hook if their website's inaccessible? You know, you don't have to worry about it because, you know, it can have a device like Rabbit or whatever comes out in the future could just, you know, get past that and get straight to what you're looking for. And if we get to that stage and it works, do we care that developers don't worry about accessibility? Yeah. Because we can still get access anyway.
Huge question. And we've at AbilityNet have done lots of posts and indeed webinars on whether AI will be able to help, you know, developers create more accessible code, browsers bridge the gap of inaccessibility when you land on a page that have got issues, you know, people who test for compliance, like AbilityNet's accessibility team do, will it help them to be able to remediate inaccessible code as well? So yeah, there's loads of kind of big questions there as well. But AI, I think, you know, we're already seeing that it plays a massive part in our daily lives, really, with particularly image you know, processing and description and stuff like that. And I guess this is just like one step further from that. It looks at each page or screen of the website or app, recognizes it, intuitively knows what things to click on. And even if they've moved or, you know, been had a new, you know, style of color of the, you know, website, like a rebrand or whatever, it won't be thrown by that. It will know exactly what to do because it kind of knows about what a web page is like and what how a UI works, you know, whether it's a date picker or a carousel or a whatever it might be. So it huge promise, I think, definitely.
It kind of reminds me of screen recognition, or at least the promise of what screen recognition was going to be, but takes it to the next level of being actually able to, you know, take part and activate those various elements. Screen recognition, when it was first released for the iPhone, was just to almost recognize elements that were unlabeled. And it never really worked for me in any way that I found particularly useful. There's these odd apps where, you know, turning it on may make some text available, but I really struggled with it. This seems like, you know, like I said, the next level.
And that's a perfect segue into another animal that we could talk about if we've got time, which is a ferret. Can we talk about ferrets?
Yes, of course let's talk about ferrets. So what is this all? Because I'm hearing this name come up a bit more. This is to do with Apple, right? This is an Apple AI.
Yeah, so everything that we've just talked about, put it into your iPhone, which is kind of what I alluded to earlier as being my preference anyway. So I don't know if it's...
So the ferret lives and the rabbit's dead.
Let's hope that they can coexist in harmony.
Yeah. Harmony.
Yeah, just near the twain. Keep one in one pocket and one in the other. So yeah, the Ferret UI is Apple's approach to... It's like the next-gen screen recognition that Sean was talking about. So they originally announced this back in October, but they've published a new paper this week on exactly what it's going to look like. I don't know if they'll announce some more at WWDC in June, but if it is going to come out in iOS 18, then they'll definitely have to. Now, what is it? It's exactly what we've been talking about. It will know about how to interact with apps and websites. So, and I'm sure it'll have S-Lady integration. So maybe from iOS 18, we'll be able to ask the S-Lady what, you know, Italian restaurants are there in a mile radius. And obviously she can do that already. She'll come back and tell you. And you could say, tell me about Romano's or something. And she'll say, I am on their homepage now. What do you want to know? So she's physically going there. I don't know whether you'll see anything on the screen or whether she's just kind of doing it in the background, but she's visiting that website. You could say, what mains do they have for vegetarians less than £10? And that may or may not be on the home screen of the website, but she'll know how to click through or tap through to get to that. Being Apple, obviously, she'll already have all of your information about Apple Pay and, you know, your address and all the things, your phone number that you might need to put in to be able to fulfill that process, that transaction. But she'll basically say, you know, everything that you need. She'll prompt you and you can say, okay, book a table for 6 for, you know, Saturday night at 7 p.m. or something.
That's incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. And ditto with apps. You know, so how much is the MX keys on Amazon today? And, you know, maybe she'll open up the app this time and she'll tell you how much and you can say, what are the tech specs? And she'll be able to access those. And there's no API here. There's no kind of previous collaboration. She's just using the app.
Yeah,
but buy it now, that sort of thing.
Proper assistant for your phone, right?
Yeah.
It's built in and it's across the entire device. And, you know, you can imagine things like booking flights, some of the challenges that we have around that as blind people. It's a horrible experience.
Absolutely.
So, you know, this can really, really help. It's fascinating to learn how this is moving along. WWDC, of course, is coming up in June 10th, and everyone's very excited about it. I certainly am. I think the three of us will probably be together that evening, all geeking out on the big announcements. Because, look, it's going to be a major one this year, potentially. Although you never know with Apple. That's the thing. You just don't know what they're going to announce.
No.
But I think if they don't, and I assume you'd agree here, that if Apple don't get their act together with AI this year, then they've got a problem.
It'll be all about the AI, definitely. And I don't think you'll hear the word ferret, just saying. But that's the
No, probably not.
Definitely
no.
The code. code name at the moment.
Robin, wonderful to talk to you. Remind people how to access AbilityNet and the services it provides.
Brilliant. So yeah, go to abilitynet.org.uk for all things technology and disability. So that's pan technology, the really, you know, whiz bang stuff right down to the simple, and pan disability. So whatever your disability or multiple disability, hopefully abilitynet.org.uk is a useful place to go.
Yeah, well, as we say on our sister TV show, Access Tech Live, we are pan disability, although I've yet to get onto QVC to sell my disability pans, but I'm hoping that day will come. Robin, as always, good to talk to you.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Robin.
And if we are allowed to get that out on air, then we will be back again next time for even more Double Tap on YouTube. Thank you, Sean.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the best of Double Tap on YouTube.
Hey guys, welcome to another episode of Double Tap on YouTube. I am Stephen Scott, and today I'm zooming back to an interview we did on Double Tap, all about the subject of social media and getting access to news. Now, of course, as blind people, keeping up to date with all these different social media platforms, all of these news feeds can be a real challenge. Of course, there's RSS readers, and now there's Mastodon, and now there's X, and there's Facebook, and all of that. How do you bring it all into one place? Could it be possible to bring everything into one single application so that we can follow along? Well, that is coming soon. Thanks to Project Tapestry from Icon Factory. Now, you might remember Icon Factory. They were behind the amazing Twitterific app, which sadly, let's just say, lost its way through no fault of Icon Factory. I got the chance to sit down with Gideon Mayhew from the company to learn about their new product and find out how they've got on since the end of Twitterific.
Thanks for having me again.
Yeah. And under slightly happier circumstances this time, because we're talking about something new and exciting. I was going to say I was not going to ask you your thoughts on what's happening over it. Is it X these days?
X, yes, yes, yeah.
I'm just leaving that open for you, to go if you want.
Yeah, we'll just let it go because it's the best forgotten and not remembered, as far as I'm concerned. So.
But it is interesting because this new app that you're working on at the moment kind of ties in social media, but also ties in other forms of media as well. So tell us about Project Tapestry.
Yeah, so after, you know, Twitter kicked us off and all third parties from Twitter, we kind of watched our friends and people we followed online split up and go their separate ways. And of course, soon after that, a whole bunch of other social media services cropped up in the wake to kind of fill the vacuum. You know, we have Mastodon has always been there, but it became popular once again. And then there's Threads and Blue Sky. And so it's become very fragmented, and we're not sure. People jump from service to service. And if you want to track a particular person's posts, it can be tricky. And we started to try to think of ways, well, how can we help this? How can we solve this problem or try to solve this problem? Anyway, and that was the brainchild behind Tapestry, which seeks to create a unified timeline of most. We can't pull in posts from Twitter or Facebook because those are walled gardens now. But services like Mastodon, Blue Sky, blogs, your favorite news sites, earthquake data, satellite data, anything that has a public IP address, really, where you can get at the source for those things can be, in theory, woven into Tapestry. And hopefully, eventually, Threads will be available for that, too. I mean, they're going to federate. That's the plan behind it. So we're confident, or at least optimistic, that Threads will be included in that as well. So,
I mean, the great thing here is you're obviously developing this as a mainstream app, but, you know, we know you and we know the apps you've created in the past. We all remember Twitterific and how terrific that was. That was an almost attempt at a pun, but it didn't quite go as I intended. But, you know, the thing here is you're developing apps that are great and really useful, but I have to say, from our point of view as a blind you know, audience here who are interested in new apps, the first thought we always have is, well, how accessible is it going to be for us?
Right.
You've already said in your website, I was reading on the Kickstarter, you know, it's right in there. You've got full support for VoiceOver. So that is just like ticked off right away, right? You're going to continue to support blind people.
Yeah, that's very, very important. It always has been for all of our apps and more so, even more so with the social type, you know, in that field where it's completely accessible and easy to navigate and easy to, you know, pull in the sources and browse what you're looking for and filter what you don't want out. You know, that's one of the main things that we want to be able to try to do with Tapestry as well, to get rid of some of the noise or the spoilers or the politics or, you know, whatever you want, but to still be aware of those sources from multiple places in the internet, but filter them to down to just what you want to focus on and what you're concerned with the most. So.
Yeah, I mean, in the blind world especially, RSS is still very popular. And it's something that we always try and seek out RSS feeds, and we try and seek out apps that are cross-platform that allow us to be able to, you know, navigate all these different sources on our devices. I mean, at the minute, a lot of blind people are using an app called Lire, L-I-R-E, which is a really good app for because it goes across both iOS and macOS. Not quite on Windows, but, you know, there are options there as well. A lot of these apps are often fragmented themselves. Right. And, you know, you have to still go off to another app to get your content. And what you're trying to build, I guess, is something that can bring all that together.
Correct. I mean, as much as we can, it's not possible, obviously, to do everything that we would like to do in the app, nor do we really want to. I mean, everyone has their own favorite Mastodon app or, you know, their own favorite web browser. And so, you know, ultimately the goal is to be able to specify those apps within Tapestry so that when you do want to interact with a post, you could easily click a button and tap something and it will take you out to that particular app so that you can interact. You can reply, favorite it, join a conversation, whatever you want to do. But Tapestry becomes the reading position, the bookmark, the I've read this, I'm aware of this app, so that you can keep track of these multiple things in a single place, and you don't have to launch 5-10 apps every day constantly, and you're switching around and looking for all these different things. It can get really overwhelming, and that's really the goal. So,
now, normally an app like this, I would imagine, would appear on the Apple App Store. It might have a fee attached to it. It may have in-app purchases. Why is it being talked about on Kickstarter? What's the reason for that?
Yeah, I mean, it really is economics. You know, we did this with Twitterific for macOS. We did a Kickstarter back in 2017 for Twitterific for the Mac, and it worked out really great. People were really willing to support the project and remove some of the risk for us. We're a small company. We don't have venture capital. We don't have angel funding to support and bolster these software development efforts from us. So it's really a risk to spend a good part of a year, maybe a year, developing a piece of software, get it in the App Store, and then only then find out if it's going to make money. And if it doesn't, it could bankrupt us, you know? So we have to try to remove that risk from the process. And Kickstarter is a great way to do that. It worked with Twitterific, and I'm optimistic to say that it's working with Tapestry. People are really willing to contribute, and it's an app that they seem to like the idea for, and they're latching onto. They're helping spread the word, and hopefully we'll get it funded. And then beyond that, we'll get to some stretch goals so that we can add more features that we really want to work on.
Yeah, and it's interesting you say that because, you know, I'm already seeing articles popping up on places like 9to5mac.com, and I'm seeing a lot of blind people talking about it as well. As soon as the word is out there, it does spread very quickly, of course, through social media, which is great. And, you know, the articles, news articles pick up because it's an interesting app from a mainstream perspective as well. And in terms of that VoiceOver support, what are you doing to ensure that it's fully accessible? Are you testing it with some blind people you've got in mind already?
We will when we get to that point. We up to now, we've only developed a really, really rough prototype to do a proof of concept of the app. We didn't want to launch the Kickstarter without knowing for sure that it wasn't going to work. And of course, when we had to do all the technical hard homework to make sure that that was the case, but it's not in a form where it can be, you know, consumed or used by the general public, not on test flight yet. But once we get past the funding portion of it and we move into active development, then yes, we're going to need active people to test voiceover and the accessibility and all of that. I encourage anyone who wants to join the project and who would be willing to do that to do so, because we need all the help we can get. That was the case with Twitterific. We had a great bevy of blind testers who helped us to stay honest and give us great feedback when it came to Twitterific. And I'm really hoping that that will be the case again for Tapestry.
You're always listening to the community, and it just shows through the apps you develop. I do have a question, though. Will it be a macOS version?
That's one of the stretch goals. We would really like to make a Mac version. And if we reach this appropriate stretch goal, we'll definitely make it. It's totally doable. There's no technical limitation there, and we want it ourselves. So hopefully we'll get a chance to make it. Everyone keeps also asking about Vision Pro, you know.
I was going to say, yeah, you do it for Vision Pro as well.
Yeah, because
Netflix to it.
The new hotness is Vision Pro and everything, but we're not going to go there right now. You know, we're a long way from even, you know, talking about that. So it would be great.
What's your thoughts? Not maybe not from Tapestry's perspective, but what's your thoughts on Vision Pro from a developer perspective? Is it just a... Because I see a lot of people saying this is almost like an aspirational project from Apple. This is not really a product they are expecting millions to sell. They're kind of just trying to put an idea out there, you know, make a few quid in the meantime.
It's a really double-edged sword as far as I am concerned. Virtual reality, virtual spaces is nothing new. It has been around for 40 some odd years. Can Apple make it mainstream? If anyone can do it, Apple can do it. They have the talent and the money and the drive in order to do that. So I'm not saying that it's impossible. It's a big hill to climb, even for Apple. To be able to convince someone that they should put on this headset and wear this with a battery pack instead of simply pulling their phone out of their pocket and doing what they need to do almost instantly is a big ask. It's friction there for the user, and the experience needs to be extremely compelling in order for people to be willing to do that. Is it enough? I don't know. I can't speak from really absolute authority because I have not tried one. I have not had the opportunity to wear one, to experience it, to use it. So I'm kind of talking out the side of my mouth on this. But from it, just of a general perspective, I'm not sold on it myself, not on the price and not on the use cases of it. You have to give me a use case for where I would be saying, oh, that's a great reason why I should put on this headset. Watching movies is one of those. Watching TV and experiencing virtual entertainment is a great use case for it. And I could totally see that becoming Vision Pro's main focus. Just like on the Apple Watch, health apps and the health tracking became the watch's primary focus. Initially, when the Apple Watch first came out, it was all third-party apps, and you can do everything on your watch. You don't need your phone anymore. That's not what happened. Over time, developers stopped developing apps for the watch because, one, it wasn't profitable. You couldn't sell those apps to the average person. But also, it's just as easy to pull that phone out from your pocket and do what you need to do as it is to look at it on your watch and interact with your watch. And even more so for Vision Pro, I would say. So it's tough. I don't pretend to know what's going to happen. I don't know if Apple's going to be successful. We'll have to wait and see. There certainly is a lot of hype.
So, well, I'm going to predict that Tapestry will be more popular than Vision Pro in the next few months. I'm almost certain of that.
Bless your heart.
I just want to, you know, thank you for what you do for the community as well, because, you know, developers who take the time to listen to us and make sure we're included, is a rare thing, unfortunately. It's becoming less rare, but
that's good.
You know, that's why I just think sometimes you just got to say, look, thanks. Thank you for what you do. It's been brilliant.
Yeah, well,
and
appreciate
good luck
that.
With it.
Thank you very much. We'll keep our fingers crossed, and hopefully we'll be talking about this again eventually another time.
Once that app is in the App Store, come back on, tell us all about it, tell us the next steps. Look forward to it.
Well, indeed.
Thanks, Gideon. Take care.
Okay, have a good day.
So there you go. Interesting conversation. We'll get Gideon back on soon. The Kickstarter has now been completed and is on its way. So we're hoping to see that app, as Gideon says, in the next 6 months. We will look forward to getting an update on that on Double Tap. For now, though, keep in touch. Tell us your thoughts on all of this. Feedback at doubletaponair.com, or you can leave us a comment below. Catch you next time.
This is the Best of Double Tap on YouTube. Find more videos and subscribe now by heading to YouTube and searching for Double Tap Video Now.
Hey guys, welcome to another episode of Double Tap on YouTube. I'm Stephen Scott.
And I'm Sean Preece. Hello.
Hello. Sean, I think today we should do something that I'm told on YouTube is a bit of a no-no. Mm. It's a bit of a moment.
Are you sure?
No, it's all right. We're not going down that road. I mean, don't get me wrong. If it gets the numbers up, I'll consider it. But I think somehow it won't go the way that the bosses think. Certainly not going to bring in any money, I'll tell you that. We're going to delve into the comments, because we get so many comments in all these different videos.
Ooh.
Don't
dangerous.
Worry.
No, dangerous.
No, it's fine. Look, I'll tell
you. I am nervous.
No, don't be. And I'll tell you why. Because we are nowhere near famous in any way. So, we're not being targeted by the trolls. You know, it's not Adele sitting here, right? It's a Dell computer that's sitting here. That's what we've got in front of us.
Oh,
right
well
now.
Done. That
thank
old
you,
joke
thank
made
you.
It.
I
might
applaud myself on that one, actually. I think I might. I can't imagine the comments after this video. But let's get into some of the comments. So, this is following a number of different episodes. The first one I'm going to talk about is, remember the Getting the Best Signal episode we did? It's where you and I talked about you changing Wi-Fi provider and also getting Wi-Fi internet provider and getting a new Wi-Fi system, a new mesh system into the house. Remember that?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I have the Orbi and I got the new Google 6E Pro mesh system, something like
catchy.
That. Yes,
yeah,
I know.
Well, Tim Dixon writes, great conversation. I have an old BT whole home Wi-Fi disk setup that I have Ethernet plugged into each to ensure best performance. It's a bit long in the tooth now and due an upgrade. My wife says very similar as well, but for different reasons. Anyway, he goes on to say, I use a PF Sense firewall, but it's falling out of support and needs replacing. I'm on the lookout for my next setup. He says the Eero's from Amazon are appealing for the lower cost and ease, but I'm also tempted by ubiquity and the ability to use the Ethernet to power them rather than power cables themselves, which is kind of cool. That means, he says, I could use a UPS, that's an uninterruptible power supply, I think, centrally to keep all the Wi-Fi up in an outage. I should say he knows what a UPS is. I was just trying to work out what it meant for me. I mean, look, a lot in there. I mean, Eero from Amazon, that's what I have, and I love them. They are very good, and they do seem to do the job. It's one of those things that, in theory, if it's good enough, you'll forget it's there. That's the point, right? It should just work.
That's what you want, yeah. Set and forget, I believe they call it. Well, firstly, I mean, I'm resisting the urge to shout out nerd because you got your system set up really nicely there. And when it comes down to which system you get next, you mentioned ubiquity, which is very much, I would say, it's almost prosumer. That's very high end and you do pay a price for that. But then that is exactly what you're talking about, Stephen, set and forget. But probably for most people, the Eero system, the Google Nest mesh system, Orbi, anything like that is going to be more than enough. But it does seem like everything you get now is going to be a mesh system anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I want to also bring in Greg Hayes' comment on this. He sent in this voicemail to us.
Stephen, Sean, this is Greg from Phoenix. I was just watching your YouTube video about connectivity. Sean, I have a feeling this is not going to be easy, but I think the only way you're going to get proper speed to your shed is to get that Ethernet cable all the way back to the main unit. where your fiber coming in is. If you're connecting Ethernet to one of the mesh routers, unfortunately, you're going to get the speed of the Wi-Fi between the two mesh routers is going to slow you down, and then you've got the Ethernet going out from there. So again, I'm sure it's not simple, and I'm getting cable all the way back to that main box might be difficult, but that's the only way you're going to get proper Ethernet speeds to your shed. Keep up the good work, guys. Love your YouTube and your podcasts every day. Bye.
Thank you, Greg. Don't you do that? Is that, are you saying, were you saying before that you were actually taking the connection from your shed, so that Ethernet cable you've got connected in your shed, back to the house and then into a mesh router or one of the mesh boxes?
Yeah, that's right. So the main router where the internet comes into my house is by the front door, and then it's connected wirelessly to a satellite router in the living room, which is what I connect this shed to via an Ethernet cable. So it's a cable to a satellite and a wireless connection to the main router. And Greg is absolutely right. And that is the issue I was running into.
Sorry, let me just clarify. Greg is absolutely right. You're an idiot.
But no. Wait, though. The Google Nest system, that Wi-Fi connection between the main router and the satellite wasn't strong enough. I was losing a lot of speed. But I swapped that out for the Netgear Orbi mesh system, and I get full speed, even with that wireless step in there. So it does depend on the system. The Google Nests are a great Wi-Fi system. I still have them up and running because all the family, everyone else upstairs, it all works fine for them. So
you get every possible combination going.
Well, the thing is that they are slightly small, a lot smaller, and the Wi-Fi signal isn't quite as strong. The Netgear Orbi, my partner absolutely hates them because they're ugly, look like massive shoeboxes. But the fact is that they pump out a really strong Wi-Fi signal, which means I get full speed Ethernet through that Wi-Fi step to the shed out here. So you are right, but it does depend on the router.
Okay. All right.
All right.
I think Greg was correct. But
he's absolutely correct.
If it's working for you, then fine, right? That's the point. It has, as long as it works for you.
And I have no choice. Let's not forget, I did mention I have a partner, and the chances of me digging up the floorboards and running an Ethernet cable around are zero. So this is my only choice, but it does work.
Yeah, there's no answer to that I can give. Because to be honest, I completely know where you're going with that. I want to argue with you, but I'm finding it difficult. That's logical. That's logical thought.
Thank you.
Thank you for that, Greg. Appreciate the voicemail. And if you do wish to leave us a voicemail, you can. It's 1-877-803-4567. I did not nearly forget that number.
No, you didn't. Well,
1-877-803-4567 is the number. Now, listen, Raz writes in following an episode which is something I've been saying for a little while now, which is enough with the robot guide dogs. Okay. Oh. That was the title of the episode. It's also something I've been saying. Raz writes, oh man, yes to all of this. I keep seeing these places bringing back the robot guide dog, and every time I can't help but think that they have never talked to a dog handler. I don't want a crappy metal box that only works in very limited conditions and was designed by people who have no idea about the history and real work my dogs do for me. And that's before the cost, which so many of these companies don't seem to understand, that the blind community has a very high unemployment rate still, and we're practically forced to live in poverty. So how do they think we'll get the money for this thing or pay for a subscription? And it's the same trouble with the canes they keep trying to build from the ground up, when it's clear they don't know how very well-engineered our canes really are. What we want and need are things like web accessibility that's actually enforced, or I would be pretty happy with a braille display that a human being could afford and which can read EPUBs. Ha ha. I struggle to argue with that.
You can't argue with any of those points. He's absolutely right. It almost seems like every couple of years I hear about the new robot guide dog, whether it's in the form of a suitcase you can hold on to that will guide you around, or whatever, an actual robot guide dog. But do these ever see the light of day in a practical sense? So far, not. That doesn't mean we shouldn't look into it and the research, but I think he's absolutely right.
I think the technology is moving along. I think that, you know, clearly there's a desire to create this. Whether there's a need for it or a want for it, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I've not met anybody who said, goodness me, I wish I could get Apple Music on my cane. So, you know, if there's that person out there, then let me know. I think innovation is good, and I think we should always encourage it. But I think we also need to, and my point is always the same, which is we've got to make sure disabled people are in the room when these things are being discussed. Because what we don't want is for a developer to go and create something to then have a situation where 7 or 8 months later, the product comes to market and no one buys it. And the developer says, but I made this for you blind people. You don't want it. No, because no one asked for it. So you've got to have a conversation. But we will always be interested in engaging. But what we will not be are beta testers at the tune of $1,000 every time. Not doing it. Just not doing it.
You're right. Absolutely.
Simon writes as well. He wrote a comment on this. He says, I definitely agree that the actual users need to be consulted more before the products become available. And especially with things like Zoom, Teams, or things like that, it would be a lot easier to do, but still does not appear to be being done. Talking, of course, about web accessibility and all of that again. I would definitely be interested in a device that genuinely met my needs. I have to say that I am probably one of the more demanding people, as I have no sense of direction, get lost super easily, so really need pinpoint accuracy guidance. So, yeah, I think... I think that's a very interesting point, actually. And you're not alone in that. I mean, you know,
I'm not pointing
yes. at Sean.
Yes, I get lost so easily. I get lost on the pavement, on the sidewalk. It's so easy to get disorientated. So, the point is, if there's any of this tech that makes our lives easier, then absolutely, of course, we're not going to say, oh, no, I don't want that. I want to stay with the traditional ways. But the fact of the matter is that there's no proven technology out there so far that really cuts it in terms of replacing a guide dog or a cane or even adding to it, making the experience better. I haven't found that yet.
Josh writes, you said that the answer to allergies is the white cane. Of course, I was talking about dogs, and many people have got allergies. So that, you know, means that, you know, oftentimes a guide dog will not be suitable to someone, and the white cane therefore would be. That certainly is the case today, Josh. But he goes on to say, you forgot to mention the other answer to allergies can be guide horses. Yeah, that's absolutely true.
Factually, that's true. Practical wise, I'm not entirely sure. No, but they are a thing, and they do exist. And I think even here in the UK, I know of one or maybe two people that use a guide horse because a dog just isn't appropriate. But there is a lot of practical things. I'm not sure how many people could make use of a guide horse.
Well, Ibrahim writes, does anybody know about any guide dog schools in the USA? I can't find any information about them. Thank you. I'm going to put that out to you guys because I have no idea. I honestly don't know about, especially in the USA, although it's something we're going to be talking about soon on the show. Not so much guide dog schools, or guide horse schools, I guess you would say, but something we will be definitely covering on a future Double Tap. So stay tuned for that. Now, another video that came up, you remember I talked about, the video was called A Plea to a Startup, and I was talking about the FreeWrite Alpha and various other devices as well that are essentially typewriters, modern day typewriters. They have e-ink screens on them instead of paper coming out of them. They are e-ink screens. You can essentially work on them. The working title, I think, or the working phrase these days is distraction-free devices. You're not going to get an email pop-up. It's not going to, you know, give you a FaceTime call right in the middle of it, you know, as oftentimes is the case. In fact, it just happened to me right there. Someone calls me right in the middle of a recording. That's what happens, right? So, you know, that's a bit of a nuisance. But the question is, how accessible were these devices? And the answer is not very. There's no audio output from them, so I can't get a screen reader in there. And that's something that really bothered me. I know that you're a little bit dismissive of this, but Matt writes in, and I think you might agree with this. He says, seriously? It's a typewriter. Typewriters have never had audio output. If you want audio output, buy a laptop. You can get one cheaper than the FreeWrite anyway. Or get a Fire tablet that you can dictate to and it will read your words back to you. Every device cannot be accessible.
Ooh, controversial. But yeah, I tend to agree. I'm just not sure of this particular device what do you call it, genre, is going to take off. I mean, basically, we're talking about Bluetooth keyboards you can type on and remembers what you typed. This is a QWERTY note taker, if you want. Unless this is almost a throwaway price tag. I can't see this taking off when you can pick up a laptop for a few hundred dollars.
We also talked on a recent episode about gaming consoles, and the title was, Is It Time to Buy a Gaming Console? You and I discussed the value, considering the so many more accessible games are coming out, which is great. And yeah. Dan writes in, my last console was a PS3, which I only played a few games on. I lost the rest of my vision fairly rapidly, where I couldn't play them much except the Soul Calibur titles. I knew them so well, I could play them with very little vision. I would like to add that this experience of playing that game without vision was very different, but I eventually learned a new way to enjoy it. It wasn't the same, but it is possible. I suspect if I actually had in-game support for non-visual play, that I would have found similar levels of enjoyment and engagement. Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, I think that the question is, can we really enjoy these games without sight? You know, these are visual experiences, and yes, there are audible components being added to them, be it a screen reader or be it a voiceover, an audio description, whatever it might be.
Audio cues, yeah.
Audio cues, all of that. Does it allow us? I think that there's two parts to this. One is, can it give us the same experience, and should it? It absolutely should. And I think for people who want to play these games, they should have the right. You know, we should be able to play these games. Of course we should. Why shouldn't we? The person who just said, you know, not everything can be accessible. Well, I disagree. I think we should try and consider that at all turns. Now, it may not be possible for some things. I mean, Grand Theft Auto 6 is coming out soon. I would love to play that game. Yes. But I think it's highly unlikely that I'm going to get a huge amount out of it. But I'd like to be proved wrong, or I'd like them to try and figure it out. So that's, I think it's about the trial, really, isn't it? It's about trying to make it accessible. I do agree to some degree not everything can be, because, I mean, I've talked recently about the Apple Vision Pro not being, you know, like needing to be accessible, was my argument. And
disgraceful.
Know, I think we've got comments coming up on that as well.
Well, the thing is, I think I tend to think that not everything can be fully accessible. But the trouble is, if you come at it, that mindset, it means you never try. Who thought the touchscreen could ever be accessible? And the fact of the matter is, it totally is, right? But back in the day, I would have said, no, you can't have that being accessible. So I suppose it comes down to that for games as well. And you mentioned GTA 6. Absolutely, I totally agree. I'd love to play that. But would it be the same experience as I remember when I used to play GTA back in the day, when I was able to see it with low vision? That's the thing I can't quite get my head around, that it's the same experience.
You got me thinking, though, because you just said there, you know, you never thought the touchscreen experience would work for you. And I guess everything we say that follows that has been answered. We can use a touchscreen. Is the experience the same using an iPhone with speech to using it visually? I'd say that it's different.
Yes.
And it's similar. And maybe that's where we need to get to. Maybe that's the answer. I think you may have solved the world's problems, Sean Priest.
Not for the first time. You're welcome.
Excellent. Well done. Well, let's move on. Can you really understand blindness by pretending? This was the video, if you remember, we talked about those sim specs that do the rounds. And James Rath, the blind filmmaker, did a video with iJustine, the YouTuber. And he was showing her not just how to use technology to simulate vision problems, but also to go one step further than that, to actually show her how to do things. And I was quite intrigued by watching her try out, for example, using voiceover and you know, showing her the challenge of that. But actually, you know, showing her a positive experience, showing her that she could use technology. And my argument was, you know, I think this is a good thing if it's being used in that way, but just to simulate vision loss, when the stats tell us that, you know, more people who try this tend to come away with a more negative attitude towards visual impairment, we need less of that in the world. So that was the thread behind the conversation. And Aoife writes in, great conversation on a very interesting topic. Completely agree that persons with lived experience have to be involved. I find it gives deeper understanding when undertaken correctly. And that's the other point. You've got to get some blind people in the room when you're doing this kind of thing. It can't just be someone who's sighted telling a bunch of sighted people, here's what being blind is like. That just doesn't marry up with anything. I've said this a million times. Take the word blind out and put any other word you can think of in, and it will not make sense as a sentence. So I think that, you know, blind people, disabled people have to be part of that conversation as well.
Well, it's something we keep coming back to, no matter what the topic is that the blind people do, or whatever disability that you happen to be talking about or looking into, then that person with that disability needs to be in that conversation, no matter what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for your comments. I can only imagine there'll be one or two that follow this. Keep that conversation coming. We'll do this again soon, because that's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for being with me again, Sean. We'll do this again soon, and we'll catch you guys on another Double Tap on YouTube.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Best of Double Tap on YouTube. New videos are published throughout the week. To make sure you don't miss out, head to YouTube and subscribe now. Search for Double Tap Video. Thanks for listening, and catch you next time.
Join us weekly for The Pulse with host Joita Gupta, who brings us closer to issues impacting the disability community across Canada. Watch The Pulse on YouTube or listen wherever you download your AMI podcasts.